potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, Armageddon Time, The Banshees of Inisherin, Enola Holmes 2, Blockbuster, and Wendell and Wild. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup, featuring a revisit to The Happening. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I am not verified. I am not Twitter blue, but I am just a plain old at Kevin Carr, as long as that platform exists until it falls into rubble into the sea.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Before I even start the new segment, I want to remind everybody to check out my new book, The Organ Grinder. It's a slasher-inspired horror novel. It came out at Halloween, and it is available for Kindle on Amazon. Just go to Amazon.com, search the Kindle store for The Organ Grinder by Kevin Carr. Usually good to put my name in there as well, because Organ Grinder will pull up a bunch of different stuff, for a wide variety of stuff if you're not in the Kindle store and you're just searching Amazon in general. I don't even know some of the stuff it's going to turn up, but you might want to have safe search on. But also you can go to fatguysatthemovies.com and look at the show notes of this episode, and I'll have a link right there so you can check that out and any of my several other books that are available on Kindle and paperback, and a couple of them even as audiobooks. But let's move on to the box office. Last week, Black Adam repeated at number one with $24.4 million. And, you know, of course, the box office pundits, because they love the fact that it's a movie that did not come out anywhere near streaming, are like, it repeated. It's still super. It still flies into top space. It did suffer a 59% drop. And that's not terrible, but it's also not great. When it comes to the percentage number, it's kind of at the high end of the stuff that Dwayne Johnson stars in, you know, those action movies like Rampage and San Andreas. It's not the highest drop he's ever suffered, but it's also not the lowest. The same thing goes for DC. I mean, this does not have the staying power that something like The Batman or Joker had, but it's also not as catastrophic as the number drop that was suffered by Green Lantern. So it's somewhere in the middle, which is okay. I think it'll this movie will leg it out to $200 million domestic. So, I mean, it's still going to be a little notch in the belt of DC, but it's not going to be a super blockbuster. Ticket to Paradise had a much better hold for about 40% down, and it's still at number two with $9.9 million. And that's actually a great hold. 40% from week to week as a drop is pretty decent. So this thing should have some legs, especially going into award season. I don't know if there's really any high ticket romantic comedies out there in the market. Pray for the Devil, which was the only new movie from last week, that had a soft opening at number three with $7.2 million. Not a big surprise with the fact that it came out Halloween weekend. Even though it's a horror movie, Halloween weekend is notoriously slow for movies because there's so many other things to do. And it was also very crowded in the marketplace for horror movies because Smile was right behind it at number four with $5.4 million. That's still a great hold. Smile has only dropped like 30-some percent every week. So it is a juggernaut of medium proportions. It's not breaking any records, but it's holding incredibly well. And then Halloween Ends suffered a 50% drop to $4.1 million for five, which isn't bad. Till came in number six with $2.4 million, which is about average. That's what they expected. The real winner again this week was Terrifier 2. It actually increased again and had $1.9 million. Now it went down to eighth place because there were, you know, some other movies in the mix ahead of it, but that's amazing for Terrifier 2. And, you know, speaking of Terrifier 2, this is a neat little piece of news. The producers have submitted it for Oscar consideration. It's not going to win anything. And they know it. That's the best part. They know that it's not going to win anything, but they're like, why the hell not? Might as well just submit it for Oscar's consideration. So, yes, it is technically an award-eligible film, because it's been out in the theaters for as long as it needs to be. And so, hey, I never thought in a million years that the producers of Terrifier 2 would get that movie in the theaters for this long and make as much money as it did and actually have an Oscar campaign. Now, you know, if they really wanted to push the Oscar campaign, they'd have Art the Clown show up at the Academy voters' houses, you know, wave at them from the corner and see how long that lasts before somebody gets arrested. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit, it's going to be a Christmas trailer. We're rolling into Christmas season. I know that we just had Halloween, and I know that it's not Thanksgiving yet, but there aren't a whole lot of Thanksgiving movies at all, let alone what comes out once a year. So there's a lot of Christmas stuff, and they tend to roll that stuff out in November. So HBO Max is going to be dropping the sequel, the other sequel, because they did A Christmas Story too. But they like to conveniently forget about this. But we have A Christmas Story Christmas, which is coming to HBO Max on November 17th.
Ralphie, promise me we're going to make this a wonderful Christmas. That would make your father so happy.
I promise.
What had I done? And now it was all up to me?
I suggest you start drinking and don't stop till New Year's.
It's the happy season.
No, Ian. When it's just us decorating, it kind of feels like child labor.
Honey, it's not labor if we don't pay you.
Yeah.
Cheers.
There'll be much mistletoe.
My dad made this all look so easy.
Peter Billingsley's coming back to play Ralphie, but it's Ralphie coming back home and trying to have the perfect Christmas with his mother and his wife and kids. I like the fact that they got Peter Billingsley back for this, but I don't get a great feeling about this, but, you know, I'll watch it. I'm curious. I'm a big enough fan of A Christmas Story to check this one out in a couple weeks. The next one I want to hit is Avatar, The Way of Water. They've got a new trailer for that, and that drops in theaters on December 16th.
We cannot let you bring your war here.
Outcast. That's all they see.
I see you.
The Way of Water connects all things. Before your birth, and after your death.
This is our home!
I need you with me.
My opinion of this hasn't changed. It looks good. I mean, you're getting a better sense now of what the imagery and sort of the emerging technology that's being used to make the underwater scenes, and it certainly looks cool. I imagine it's going to look fantastic in IMAX 3D. And I'm hoping that when they do screen this, and if I get invited to it, that they do an actual full-blown IMAX 3D screening, which I don't know if they will. But, you know, it's interesting about this is I was thinking about this, not as much as writing on this as was writing on Avatar. Because Avatar, when it came out, Avatar's budget was $237 million. And at the time, it was the third highest budget ever. Only to be beaten by Harry Potter 6 and Spider-Man 3, which each had around $250 million. And those were parts of series and franchises. But the fact that this was an original property that was given this big of a budget. But now what's interesting is back then it was the third highest. Now it ranks as the 23rd highest budgeted film. So it's kind of insignificant almost at this point. And actually, if you adjust for inflation, its budget now would be $327 million. The new movie is about $250 million. So actually, it's a lower budget when adjusted for inflation. So the second movie is a lower budget. And Disney, their standard tent poles are $200, $250 million anyways. So this is nothing different for Disney. Disney does this for Marvel movies, and they did it for the Star Wars movies. In fact, if you look at the 22 movies that are above Avatar in terms of budget, only 8 of them weren't Disney movies. So, you know, Disney holds the top 5 spots over the Justice League for the highest budgeted movie. So this is not as big of a risk, you know, if this thing doesn't do well, which it should. I have faith. And the trailer looks pretty good. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I got a look at Armageddon Time and Wendell and Wyatt.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump with both feet in and talk about some movie reviews. Let's talk about Armageddon time. A child of Jewish immigrants deals with prejudice in his community and school in the 1970s.
I think I want to be an artist when I grow up.
You're going to be an artist if you want to be. Nothing's going to stop you.
You're going to college.
You'll have dinner with kings if he plays his cards right.
My parents are sending me to my brother's school.
That's heavy.
Someone's bugging you. What is it?
Sometimes kids say bad words about the black kids.
Who's that?
Somebody from my old school.
Did they ever come to your house?
What'd you do when that happens?
Obviously nothing, of course.
There are certain types of movies that you see every year in award season. One of them is like biopics. You're always seeing biopics around this time of year. But the other thing you see are told from the perspective of this person after they were growing up. Like last year we had The Tender Bar, which is that one with Ben Affleck. It was on Amazon Prime. And it was the story of the writer. And it's about this kid who goes to school to be a journalist. And this is basically director James Gray giving his look at how he was growing up as the child of Jewish immigrants from Europe who fled Nazis in World War II. And what it was like going to school at that time and dealing with what his impressions were of the school and his family. And of course, then you're shown how it's different. Now, there's some good things about this movie. I mean, it certainly authentically captures the 70s or late 70s, early 80s without leaning into the, gosh, weren't they great? Look at the nostalgia. It's just sort of like the setting of the movie. And it does show some of the views of the day. And there's some interesting things it does because, you know, these are kids who, if, you know, it's in the 70s, they would have been born in the 60s. So 20 years past World War II. But, like, their grandparents and their extended family are very, very aware of what happened in World War II because they're the ones who left. The best character is played by Anthony Hopkins, who's the kid's grandfather. And a lot of his scenes are great because he like talks about his family history and how they were a Jewish family from the Ukraine and how they had to flee because people just wanted to kill him because of anti-Semitism. And it's unfortunately very prescient for today because right now there's a rampant attack of anti-Semitism in the world today. I mean, I'm not just talking about Kanye West, but he exemplifies part of it. And you're seeing a lot of that hate speech online. And it's not just anti-Semitism. There's a lot of racism and xenophobia that's going on right now. And that happens all the time, but it's really sort of ramped up recently. So there's elements to this movie that are very relevant to what's going on today. But the problem is, The movie's just boring. I'm sorry. And I'm not even going to mince words anymore. When a movie's boring, I'm just going to tell you it's boring. It struggles to have any sort of focus because in a lot of ways, I think the director's a little too close to the material because he's like, well, this is what happened in the 70s. There's no pragmatic narrative story to this. It's just sort of this mosaic of life. And I know that that's a style, but I've seen so many movies like this. And it just doesn't have anything that makes it pop and is original. Plus, the cinematography is all dark and hard to watch. It's funny. I got a friend, a listener of the show, and he's blind. And he sent me a message on Facebook. He's like, hey, you know, if you're having trouble seeing some of these movies, you can always see if they got descriptive services. Because, you know, for blind people, they actually have those. And some movies provide it in the theater. And certainly a lot of DVDs and Blu-rays include descriptive services. It's distracting if you're not blind, but if you are blind or have vision problems, it's a godsend to sort of enjoy the movies again. So yeah, I think I might have to do that, Chris, at some point when I'm starting to see movies where I can't even see the face of the person who's talking because they don't actually put a freaking light in the room. So anyways, the movie, it boils down to the fact that this guy had crappy parents and he was a crappy kid and he lived with crappy people. The only one who's decent was his grandfather. And there's some really nice messaging there and some really good stuff with the grandfather played by Anthony Hopkins, but really not enough to kind of go through the rest of the movie. It's like you have these like peak moments and they're all in the trailer. You know, these four or five moments where you're like, those are gold. And then everything else is just dirt. So, yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of Armageddon Time. I mean, the story stumbles around too much, and while it makes great points, it shambles too much getting there. We've all seen movies like that. So I'm going to have to say Armageddon Time kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Wendell and Wilde. This is a stop-motion animated film directed by Henry Selick, who did movies like Coraline and actually directed The Nightmare Before Christmas, even though everybody attributes that to Tim Burton. But this movie weaves the tale of an orphan who finds a connection to demons in the underworld who promise to bring her parents back.
I know what you are, Cat. You're a Hellmaiden. But it has to be our secret. That's how I can protect you.
Protect me from what?
Your demons.
We are the magician mortician, the artiste of the afterlife.
Cat's demons are raising an army of the dead.
Ding dong!
Got you.
My demons, my problem.
I don't know. I'm really conflicted with this movie because there's some parts of it that I think are beautiful and out of the box. And I love Henry Selick's work with stop motion animation. I mean, he's a master of storytelling. He has to have the right source material, though, because if the adaptation isn't great, it can be a little bit slow. It's hard to film something at a snail's pace and then really know how it's going to fit together and be able to put it together, you know, at real time. So there's some out of the box thinking and some really cool designs, but the story just kind of seems to be all over the place. And part of it is because Selick developed this. It was an unpublished book that he did, and he worked with Jordan Peele to put together the script. So there's elements that you can really tell are Jordan Peele, because if it were done by just a white guy who did stop motion, it would just be considered horribly racist, because it leans into these weird stereotypes. But even outside of that, the story's out there, but also weirdly grounded, that kind of slows it down a little bit. Sort of reminds me of Corpse Bride. You know, this is another Tim Burton stop motion thing that Selick wasn't involved in, but Corpse Bride does not have the energy and pacing that one of these stop-motion movies really should have. I tried to watch it a couple years ago again, and, you know, it was really had some pacing problems. And I feel like that's the same thing with Wendell and Wilde. I mean, there's some really neat stuff. And, I mean, it is bizarre and strange, and it's not talking down its audience. So there's some elements of it that I love. But there's also some elements that I really don't think work and don't land. While it has the fascination and imagination of Henry Selick's work, the movie struggles to maintain focus, often awkwardly trying to balance pop culture imagery with charm. And that doesn't always work. And sometimes it just feels like it's forced in that sense. So I'm still going to say I liked it because it's different. It's on Netflix. It's getting a little bit of a bump. It was watched a lot this week. Because of the Halloween angle, but, you know, so I'm going to still say Wendell and Wilde kind of rocks, but it's not the best of his work.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, I'm going to be talking about The Banshees of Inisherin and Enola Holmes 2. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about The Banshees of Inisherin. This was in limited release for the last couple weeks. It is now going wide, so you can catch it pretty much anywhere, but it's a theatrical exclusive. Two longtime friends in 1920s Ireland suddenly have a falling out, leaving one man perplexed and the other desperate to move on.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you.
Well, you didn't do anything to me.
I just don't like you no more. You liked me yesterday.
Why does he not want to be friends with you no more? Why is he 12?
If you don't stop talking to me, and if you don't stop bothering me, I have a set of shears at home, and each time you bother me from this day on, I'll take those shears, and I'll take one of my fingers off with them, and I'll give that finger to you until I have no fingers left.
This is directed and written by Martin McDonagh, who did movies like Seven Psychopaths and In Bruges and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And for the most part, I do like his stuff. I do want to go back and rewatch In Bruges, because the thing that one has Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson in it, and this one reunites the two of them. And McDonagh, he does a lot of stuff. He got known in theater, and now he does stuff in movies as well. But he's known for doing dark comedies and sometimes having absurdist angles to him. And this one certainly fits the bill, because it basically starts off Colin Farrell's character, Pyrrhic, just comes to the pub one day and is trying to have a pint with his friend, Brendan Gleeson, who plays Cullum. But he's just like, nope, we're not friends anymore. And he really doesn't have an explanation. He just decides, I don't want to be friends with you anymore. You're a waste of time, essentially. And so he had this epiphany about it, and he's determined, I mean, determined to shun Pyrrhic as a friend. And Pyrrhic is just devastated. He doesn't know why, and he's not the smartest guy, but he seems like a perfectly nice guy. And it examines the difference between being a friend and being nice, and what you leave to this world. Because this is all told on this fictitious little island in Ireland. It's beautiful. I mean, it's gorgeous. Oh, my God. It's a beautiful landscape and the seascape. And across the bay or the sound or whatever, they can see the tip of Ireland there. And there's the Irish Civil War going on. So all this beauty is against this backdrop of this violence that is happening in the background, but they're shielded from it. And the same thing's kind of happening with their relationship, because there's no real pragmatic explanation for it, very much like war. And it also has this two completely opposing viewpoints that don't have any middle ground. And that's the thing. He says, Cullum wants to stop being friends, and Pyrrhic wants to continue to be friends. And that's where the conflict is. And it shows sort of the way the people are in the village and how people are interacting with them and how people don't want to get involved, but they don't want to see any sort of bad things happening. And there's other people in the village who are genuinely not nice people, but these two guys tend to be nice people. And just like silly stuff that goes on in this movie. Like, Pyrrhic's best friend is his donkey. I mean, like, quite literally, he brings it in the house because he's lonely. I mean, it's just a real charm to it. But it doesn't get pretentious. It doesn't explain itself to you. It just presents itself as this completely absurd and silly and at times shocking situation. So this movie surprised me. It was one of those, I knew nothing about it. And I wasn't even aware. I think I knew that the director had done In Bruges, but I'd forgotten that he had done Three Billboards, which I loved. And I really don't remember much about Seven Psychopaths, so I really didn't have much to go on. And it's been, 15 years since I've seen In Bruges. But I just fell in love with this movie. It's charming and funny. I mean, it's dark and absurd, and it's awful, just hilarious. As an examination of friendship against the backdrop of beauty and violence, it's a brilliant film. It's one of the best of the year. So I'm going to have to say The Banshees of Inisherin totally rock.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about another Netflix film, Enola Holmes 2. Millie Bobby Brown returns as the famous detective's sister who has opened her own business and is on the case to find a missing factory worker.
My name is Enola Holmes. I started a detective agency.
How old? You're a girl.
Tell me.
Yes.
Might your brother be free?
My brother? Well, I have not a single case. Sherlock Slater seems to be vexing him.
Is it true you find lost people?
Yes.
My sister. She disappeared a week ago.
At last, I would be a detective in my own right, worthy of the Holmes name.
If you recall, Enola Holmes, the first one came out a couple years ago. And Netflix got sued for it by the family and estate of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And as what happens whenever you have a famous person who created something, as Arthur Conan Doyle did with the Sherlock Holmes character, his family just wants to live off that. Nobody wants to work. Nobody wants to work nowadays. But the family of Arthur Conan Doyle sued because, and it's this weird thing when it comes to the rights to Sherlock Holmes, because most of it's in the public domain. Most of it has cleared copyright. Except for this handful of stories that Arthur Conan Doyle wrote, like, very late in life. And they still are under that window of copyright. And the difference that they use is they say, in those, Sherlock Holmes has a little bit of humanity to him. Because if you know anything about the character of Sherlock Holmes, he was a real pariah. He didn't like people. He didn't understand people. He hated dealing with people. And the only reason he wanted to solve murders wasn't because he felt bad for the victims, but because it was a problem to solve. And he was very good at that. And later in his, literary career, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle put some humanity. He made him nice to Watson a couple times. I mean, earlier stuff, he's just dismissive. He just treats Watson as like a pet, you know? So because the character of Sherlock Holmes originally showed up in the first movie, played by Henry Cavill, and he had a certain degree of niceness to him, they're like, you stole this from these later works. And then Netflix had to settle because they were making this Enola Holmes too. And I really enjoyed that first movie. And this one cut completely from the same cloth. It feels the same way. It has the same punchy energy. It's got Millie Bobby Brown turning and breaking the fourth wall, talking to the camera, which he does in the first movie. You know, she didn't steal that from She-Hulk. And She-Hulk didn't steal it from her either. This is just, it's a standard convention. I mean, the movie Tom Jones has breaking the fourth wall. So, you know, people need to chill out. Heck, Return of the Vampire from the 40s had breaking the fourth wall. So this is nothing new. Anyways, this movie's good. I mean, it's got some really neat stuff. And one of the things it does, because of course she's a teenage girl in, let's just say, feministically challenged times, you know, women did not have a whole lot of rights back then. You know, talking Victoria age, which is odd because you had a queen running the show, but who cares? And one of the things I complained about with that Lena Dunham, Catherine Birdie movie that little bit ago, and same thing with Rosaline, was you get too much of this modern attitude of like going, oh, why can't I do everything I want to because I'm a woman and you're a big sexist. They lay that on a little too thick in some of these things. In Enola Holmes, that sentiment's there where Enola gets frustrated that she can't do what her brother does and people look down on her because she's a woman. Also, she's a child or she is young. She's like 18. I don't know how old the character is. But while that sentiment is there, it's not complaining about it. It's just, it shows the frustration of it and it presents it as saying this is the way it was. And she's going to do her little bit to try and change that, but she's not going to just overhaul. And she's not going to act like a modern woman either with all these rights already. She's got to fight for them. And it has a neat little mystery that takes time to solve. And it doesn't really cheat you. And it has a bunch of Easter eggs for a bunch of Sherlock Holmes elements. They're certainly going to want to make another one, I'm sure, if this one does well. It's cute and neat. I mean, it's a fun movie. And if you like the first one, you should like this one, too. I mean, you know, it's carried by the energy of Millie Bobby Brown. But it's an energetic romp through the underbelly of Victorian London as a fun and compelling mystery. I'm going to say Enola Holmes 2 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, a review of Blockbuster from Netflix. Weird. And the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Happening. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish things up with Blockbuster, and it's a series. That's, I guess, the big difference in my mind. It's not a movie. This workplace comedy features the last remaining Blockbuster and the employees trying to keep it open on Netflix.
Look, there's no easy way to say this. 7 more Blockbusters just closed. You're officially the last one on Earth.
I don't love the pattern that's starting to emerge. Hello.
How am I supposed to be the next Tarantino if I don't work at a video store?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what's holding you back.
No one's going anywhere because everything is under control.
That's reassuring.
Just act like one of your favorite bosses from a movie.
Like Boss Baby or Devil's Advocate?
One of those is a baby and one is Satan.
And look at the heights they reach despite their circumstances.
Fair.
What's funny is there's 10 episodes. used to be, you know, during broadcast TV before streaming, they'd order a show and you get like 13 episodes, unless it was like a mid-season replacement, and sometimes you only got six. But you get like 13 episodes, and if it did well, you get the back nine, so you'd end up with like 22 episodes, which is an absurdly large amount of shows for a year. In most other countries, you may, like in Britain, you'll get like six episodes a season, maybe eight, maybe 10. And then when they went to streaming, they would do them, especially Netflix, you'll get 8 to 10 episodes. And they'll drop them all at the same time. So they're done. There's no going back and retooling the show. Whereas it's very common in older TV shows, sitcoms and dramas and everything back during broadcast is, you know, they do the first so many episodes and then things were in a pipeline and they'd start to air. And when they were getting responses and they were trying to tweak it to try and perfect the show, that's why so many first seasons of a series are kind of haphazard and awkward and kind of go all over the place. There's that show. You remember that it was, I forget what it was called, but it had like Richard Lewis and Jamie Lee Curtis in it. I remember watching the first season of that. I got it on DVD to review like 20 years ago. And the first like two or three episodes are vastly different than like episodes 7, 8, 9. And that's because they started to air and they said, ooh, let's change this. Let's tweak the formula. And eventually got a really good formula between Lewis and Curtis doing their own show. But it's very different than what started. The Office is another great example. The original American Office was very much like the British Office, very dry. And they built it up and made it more absurd and crazy and over the top and Americanized it for the second season. But you don't get that with these streaming series. They drop them all, and so they're not going to adjust it for those episodes. And this show has some really great stuff in it. I mean, it has some very funny moments. In fact, the writing is quite stellar at times. When I say writing, I'm talking the joke running. Because there's two aspects of the writing, and one of them's great, the other one's very mundane. But the joke writing, the one-liners and the references, those are very, very funny. And the structure of some of the characters are extremely funny. Every episode, there's at least a couple laugh-out-loud moments where I'm like, "That now that's a funny joke." And that landed. That was great. The other aspect of the writing, which is the stories, they got a lot to be desired. Because, you know, it's the Vanessa Ramos is the showrunner, or at least she created it. And she had worked on, the people who did this, they had worked on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and they'd worked on Superstore. Superstore gets listed first in that for some reason. And it's clear that a lot of these elements to the stories, they're like, let's take these cliches that you have in every workplace comedy, like these two main characters that like each other but don't want to admit it, and really something's keeping them apart, but will they, won't they? It's those kind of stories. And then you got the character with the overbearing parents, and then you got kind of like the crazy worker there, and they have all that, but it just seems like they're just drawing right out of cliches on that one. Then they're not original at all, and that kind of stuff really only works on broadcast. It doesn't work well in a binge format, so it seems awkwardly put together. It's uneven, and I think they can streamline stuff and make it funny, and that's their strength, rather than worrying about whether these two characters are ever going to sleep together. Also, it has some weird choices have been made in this one. Like, the actual last blockbuster is in Bend, Oregon. Yet somehow this is somewhere in some random strip mall in Michigan. I don't know why they made that change. Maybe because they wanted to make it a little more middle American, although I never thought of Michigan as middle American. I mean, it's either out in the wilderness or you're talking Detroit, you know? So, usually, I'm from Columbus, Ohio. You wanted to do something middle American, you said it takes place in Ohio. So it just, there's some choices that are weird about it, but it's certainly compelling and fun to watch. There's only one or two episodes that I really kind of rolled my eyes and said, okay, I'm not into this. Or the character acting so stupid, it doesn't carry the show. But, you know, hey, the dialogue has a nice selection of zingers and the cast is fun. Although the episodes often fall into the extreme cliches of workplace comedies. But still, like I said, it's a nice mindless watch. It's just weird that it's a blockbuster love fest on Netflix of all places, which killed Blockbuster, even though Blockbuster killed most independent video stores. Anyways, I'm going to still say that Blockbuster kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I'm going to go back in the past about 15 years to talk about a movie that I've always had a soft spot for. And earlier this week on Monday was Halloween. And leading into Halloween, I was watching a bunch of horror movies because that's what I do. And you know what? I don't stop doing that. I'm still going to be watching horror movies now. But one of the movies that I picked, I had it in my queue because it's on HBO Max right now. And that is The Happening, directed by M. Night Shyamalan. And this movie gets a lot of hate. And I hadn't seen it since I saw it in the theater in 2008. And I personally like most of what M. Night Shyamalan does. No, some of his stuff's crap. Another Earth was awful. Or After Earth. Whichever one he did. The Visit was eh. And that last Airbender movie was just an absolute travesty. But in general, I like the stuff that he does. You know, all the way from The Sixth Sense. And yes, including stuff like Lady in the Water. And when he was doing Glass and, Split. So in The Happening, a high school teacher tries to save his wife and friends from a mysterious event in which people are inexplicably committing suicide in high numbers.
Homeland Security and the CDC
has reported attacks. Boston, Philadelphia,
Maryland. White House officials claim the CIA has a defense against chemical weapons.
I don't understand what you're saying. She says everyone's dead outside.
What's going on?
We lost contact.
With whom?
Everyone.
This was probably one of the last movies before M. Night Shyamalan really became the butt of every joke. The movie itself, I thought, was pretty chilling. I mean, okay, are all the complaints about this true? Yes, some of the acting is weird. I'm not going to say it's bad acting, because I don't actually think it's bad acting. I think he's directing them to act a certain way that is deliberately confusing, and it can come across as bizarre. And he's having people say and do weird things because they're so off-put by what's going on that they don't know how to process it. I think that the problems in the dialogue and delivery are actually deliberate because of the situation. And I find that also kind of what's off-putting about the movie. It has some great imagery and it has a great idea, but I still think it's effectively done. There's some very grisly moments to it that are very uncomfortable. And his the ultimate explanation for what's going on, and I'm not going to spoil it. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. At least give it a chance. But I actually think the idea is incredibly disturbing. And yeah, you may not like his delivery of it, but his delivery is very Twilight Zone comic book-ish. And he really lays it on thick here. And he breathes a lot in this movie. And I think those are the things that people complained about. But you know, overall, going back and rewatching it, I was impressed. I thought we actually ended up with a chilling, disturbing movie that actually makes me question, could this event really? I mean, yeah, people make fun of it, but just because you can make fun of an event doesn't mean that it's not possible in some bizarre, strange way. And it's one of those that you think, what would you do? How would you react to a situation like that? And there's some ultimately disturbing moments where, you know, people are talking to their loved ones on the phone and bad things start happening. And you know, how do you respond to that sort of thing? So as much as everybody makes fun of this movie and loves to get on their high horse and poo-poo it and look down their nose at it, give it a chance. Treat it like an old 1950s suspense thriller of unknown sci-fi proportions. And I think it's very effective that way. I'm still going to say The Happening rocks. Go check it out. HBO Max.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it for Fat Guys at the Movies this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.